Welcome to the History Maps podcast. Today, we are taking a deep dive into an empire that, well, it frequently gets reduced to a single image in the popular imagination. You know, war, elephants trudging through the snow across the Alps.
Right, the classic Hannibal narrative.
Yeah, but Carthage was far more than an empire of merchants, and it was certainly more than a single military campaign led by Hannibal. It was a highly complex, multi-ethnic military corporation. So the mission for you today is to explore the sheer scale, the intricate economics, and the staggering logistics of the Carthaginian war machine. We are going to trace its history from its founding in 814 BCE all the way to its ultimate destruction.
And that is a really crucial lens to use. There is an old military adage that says, amateurs talk tactics, professionals study logistics.
I like that.
Yeah. And if you really want to understand the ancient Mediterranean, you have to lean heavily on that idea. People often get caught up in the romance of battlefield maneuvers, you know, the flanking charges and heroics.
Sure, the exciting stuff.
Right. But to understand Carthage, you have to look at its ledgers. You have to look at the accounting. The true power of Carthage was not just the famous war elephants. It was the enormous economic engine that funded them, fed them, and put them on the battlefield in the first place.
So to comprehend how they fielded armies of that scale, we need to look at how they evolved. I want to trace that foundation. The sources point to 814 BCE. Phoenicians from the city of Tyre established the colony of Carthage on the coast of North Africa.
In modern-day Tunisia, yeah.
Right. Now, at that point, it was a minor power. It was ruled by an appointed governor. And if they needed to fight, they just called up a regular citizen levy fighting in the traditional Eastern style.
Which was very typical for the ancient world.
Yeah, a fairly standard city-state setup. So how do we get from that to a continent-spanning military corporation?
Well, the geopolitical landscape shifted. Their mother city of Tyre began to decline because of pressures in the Near East. And that opened up a power vacuum in the Western Mediterranean.
And Carthage is perfectly situated to step into that void.
Exactly. Precisely. They were right at the nexus of the major maritime trade routes. So by the time we reach 550 BCE, a leader named King Mago I initiates a series of critical reforms.
Magarba's vision was to assert absolute dominance over that Western Mediterranean trade network, right?
Yes. He forged alliances with the Etruscans of northern Italy, specifically to counter the influence of the Greek city-states, who were, at the time, expanding very aggressively.
So Mago I starts building a true empire. And this is where we start seeing the physical footprint of their military ambition. Reading through the sources about the infrastructure they built, the scale is genuinely difficult to wrap your head around.
It is vast.
They constructed three rings of walls protecting the city, and embedded within those walls were barracks capable of housing 24,000 infantry, 4,000 cavalry, and 300 elephants.
Which is basically an entire metropolitan district dedicated purely to housing a standing army.
And they're animals. I mean, the logistics of that physical space alone are staggering.
Think about what it takes to simply feed 300 elephants inside a walled city every single day.
I cannot even imagine.
Right. An adult elephant requires hundreds of pounds of forage and dozens of gallons of water daily. You have to bring all that material into the city, distribute it, and then manage the immense amount of waste produced.
That requires a huge corps of quartermasters, stable hands, and transport wagons moving constantly.
And that is just the animals. You also have 28,000 soldiers who need rations, fresh water, sanitation, weapon maintenance. That infrastructure reflects a profound shift in how the state operated. They were building a permanent, institutionalized machine for war.
But the political mechanics controlling that machine seem just as intricate as the physical walls. If we look at their political structure, they had a Senate and a popular assembly.
Right.
But the way they handled military command was distinctly different from their eventual great rival, Rome. I want to unpack that because it seems to dictate their entire strategy.
It absolutely dictated their strategy. In Rome, you had consuls who were elected for a one-year term. And they held both civil and military authority. They led the armies, and they ran the state.
Carthage separated those powers entirely, though.
Yes, completely. The Punic generals, the title was the Rab Mahanet, they were elected by the popular assembly. And unlike a Roman consul, a Carthaginian general held an unlimited term.
So they served for the duration of a war.
Which provided crucial strategic continuity. But, and this is the vital part, they possessed strictly military authority. They had absolutely no civil power back home.
And the state kept them on a very short leash. The sources detail a body known as the Court of 104.
the Oversight Committee.
Yeah, and they were utterly ruthless. When a Carthaginian general returned from a campaign, especially an unsuccessful one, they faced this court. The consequences for failure were severe. We are talking about public trials, heavy fines, torture, or even crucifixion.
Yes, crucifixion was a genuine threat for a failed general.
By their own government.
Oh, absolutely. The Court of 104 was designed to ensure that the military never threatened the civilian oligarchy. The generals were in command of tens of thousands of armed men, often for years at a time. The state was terrified of a military coup.
So they instituted the ultimate form of accountability. I was thinking about this, and the best analogy I can come up with is a modern corporate structure where the general is a CEO hired solely to execute a hostile takeover.
That is a good way to look at it.
They are given the budget and the personnel. But if they fail to deliver the expected return on investment, the board of directors, the Court of 104, literally executes them.
Right.
Which brings up a question I kept coming back to. If you know that losing a battle means you might be nailed to a piece of wood by your own government, doesn't that extreme accountability rob Carthaginian generals of the bold aggressiveness we so often see in Roman commanders?
It fundamentally altered their risk calculus. The threat of crucifixion created a highly conservative, asset-protecting military doctrine. Carthaginian generals were not typically risk-takers.
Because the downside was just too high.
Exactly. I mean, their primary goal was rarely pure territorial expansion or conquest for the sake of glory, which you see constantly in Rome. Their goal was maintaining commercial monopolies and preserving the status quo.
Can you give me an example of how that conservative strategy played out in reality?
Sicily is the perfect example. For centuries, Carthage and the Greek city-states fought over Sicily. But Carthage rarely tried to conquer the entire island outright.
They just wanted a foothold.
They would intervene to support one faction or another, applying just enough military pressure to maintain a balance of power. They wanted to ensure no single entity grew strong enough to threaten their maritime trade routes.
So the military was utilized as a scalpel to protect investments, not a broadsword to conquer the world.
Right. They were protecting the trade network. As long as the merchant ships could sail safely, the generals were doing their jobs.
So the strategy was conservative, which leads directly into how they built the army itself. Because the state punished failure so severely, and because their entire society was built on commercial enterprise, Carthaginian leaders naturally sought to insulate their most valuable asset from the risks of war.
And that most valuable asset was their own citizenry.
Right. The citizens were the economic engine. And there was a very specific historical catalyst that changed how Carthage viewed citizen soldiers, wasn't there?
Yeah, it occurred during the Sicilian Wars of the 6th and 5th centuries BCE. Carthage sent large citizen armies to fight the Greeks in Sicily, and they suffered disastrous defeats, particularly at the Battle of Himera in 480 BCE.
The casualties among the Carthaginian citizens were exceptionally high there.
Right. And you have to think about how a society that relies on trade reacts when a large portion of its merchant class just doesn't come home. The psychological and economic shock to the city was profound.
Because a dead citizen is not just a tragedy.
No, it is a permanent loss of a skilled shipwright, an experienced navigator, or a wealthy merchant who pays taxes. The Carthaginian state effectively realized that sending their mercantile population into a meat grinder was terrible for business.
The opportunity cost of a citizen dying in battle was simply too high.
So they vowed to stop risking their own people, and they shifted to an outsourced military model.
This is where we need to clear up a major misconception. When you read ancient historians like Polybius and Livy, they constantly hammer this idea that Carthage relied on mercenaries.
You do, yeah.
They use the term almost as a pejorative, drawing a sharp contrast between Carthage's hired guns and Rome's noble citizen levies. But digging into the sources, that term mercenary is actually quite misleading, isn't it?
It is a profound oversimplification, often driven by Roman propaganda. I mean, while Carthage did employ true mercenaries, soldiers of fortune fighting purely for a paycheck, the vast bulk of their army consisted of Libyans and Libyphoenicians.
And these were people living in the territories surrounding Carthage in North Africa.
Yes. They were subjects or vassals of the Carthaginian Empire. They were bound by specific treaties to supply manpower as a form of tribute.
So when Polybius calls a Libyan heavy infantryman a mercenary, he's being inaccurate. That soldier is essentially a conscript from a subjugated state, fulfilling a political obligation.
Right. They were fulfilling a treaty obligation.
Mm-hmm.
Though it is important to note they were paid and provisioned for their service. but they were not independent contractors shopping their swords to the highest bidder. They were the backbone of the empire's military structure.
But Carthage did also hire the true professionals, the independent contractors. And the logistics of doing that are really interesting. To build this army, Carthage had to dispatch ambassadors and hiring officers to distant lands, places like Gaul, Greece, and the Iberian Peninsula.
It was a massive, highly complex diplomatic and commercial endeavor.
How did that recruitment process actually work on the ground?
Well, a Carthaginian officer would travel to, say, the Iberian Peninsula. They would have to sit down with tribal chieftains or mercenary captains, often requiring interpreters to negotiate contracts.
They had to agree on the wage, right?
Yeah, the missos, which is the base wage. But they also had to iron out compensation for daily food rations, travel expenses from their homeland to the theater of war, and sometimes even stipulate who paid for replacement equipment if a sword broke or a shield was shattered.
And to fund this globe-spanning recruitment drive, Carthage had to leverage its immense wealth. The sources note that around 410 BCE, Carthage minted its very first coinage.
Right. Prior to this, they were largely operating on a barter and bullion economy.
But the historical record indicates they started minting coins specifically to pay these troops.
Because mercenaries often demanded a substantial lump sum payment up front before they would even agree to march. You cannot pay 10,000 Gauls with promises or heavy bars of raw bullion. They need transportable standardized currency.
So Carthage minted silver.
Yes. And to generate this kind of liquid capital, Carthage heavily exploited the silver mines in the Iberian Peninsula. They also levied strict taxes on their agricultural subjects in North Africa, and they squeezed their vast maritime trade network, applying tariffs and customs duties to generate every available ounce of profit.
I want to push back on the economic logic here, though. Let us say I am the Carthaginian Senate. I govern the wealthiest city in the Mediterranean. Why am I spending vast fortunes, literal tons of silver-paying foreigners to fight my wars, instead of simply arming my own people?
It is a fair question.
Even if citizens are valuable, surely paying citizens a wage keeps the wealth inside the city, rather than shipping it off to Gaul or Iberia.
It comes down to a cold, highly calculated economic formula. Let us break down the math from their perspective. A Carthaginian citizen is far more profitable to the state when they are working in the commercial, maritime, or agricultural sectors.
Because they generate taxes.
Right. A citizen who manages a trade fleet, generates revenue, and pays taxes year after year for decades. If that citizen puts on a bronze breastplate, marches into Sicily, and is killed by a Greek spear, the state has lost a lifetime of future revenue.
So a citizen is a long-term revenue-generating asset.
Yes. A foreign mercenary, however, was viewed as a purchased, expendable asset. You pay a Gaulish warrior a flat fee. If that warrior perishes in battle, the silver you paid him is a sunk cost, yes. But his death does not damage the domestic economic engine of Carthage.
Because the merchant fleets still sail.
And the fields are still harvested. You simply take more trade profits and go out and purchase another mercenary. To the Carthaginian oligarchy, human life on the battlefield was a renewable resource, provided you had the silver to buy it.
And they bought a truly astonishing array of warriors. Once the silver was minted and the recruiters were dispatched, they assembled a multi-ethnic roster that reads like a catalog of the ancient Mediterranean's most lethal fighters.
It really does.
I want to examine the specific units this wealth procured, because understanding how these different groups fought explains why Carthage was so formidable. Let us start in the Iberian Peninsula. What did Carthage get when they hired Iberian infantry?
Well, the Iberians were highly prized as shock troops and line infantry. They were generally divided into two categories based on their equipment. You had a heavy infantry known as the Scutari.
And what did they carry?
They carried long, flat, oval, or rectangular body shield, which provided excellent coverage in a tight formation. Then you had the light infantry, the Caetrati, who utilized small, round bucklers called a Caetara.
So they were more mobile.
Much more mobile, yeah.
Yeah.
It allowed them to excel at skirmishing and flanking. Visually, they were very distinct, too. They often wore white tunics that were trimmed with a deep purple border.
It is their weaponry that really stands out in the sources, though. They carried a weapon called the Solifera. How did that function?
The Solifera is a fascinating piece of engineering. Most ancient javelins consist of a wooden shaft with an iron point attached to the end. The Solifera was a heavy javelin forged entirely out of a single piece of iron.
No wood at all.
None. Because it had no wooden shaft to absorb the impact or snap, all the kinetic energy of the throw was concentrated on the very narrow point. It was designed for maximum armor-piercing capability.
Oh, wow. Wait, I shouldn't say wow, but that is intense.
It is. If an Iberian threw a Solifera at a shielded opponent, the sheer weight of the iron would often drive it straight through the shield and into the man holding it.
That is terrifying. But their signature weapon, the one that really seems to leave a mark on history, is the Falcata. What made this sword so effective?
The Falcata is a masterpiece of ancient metallurgy and design. It is a curved sword, but the blade curves forward toward the opponent before widening near the tip.
So it is top heavy.
Yes. This design shifts the center of gravity further down the blade. So when an Iberian warrior swings a Falcata, it possesses the cutting power and forward momentum of an axe, but still retains the cutting edge of a sword.
So it could just hack right through things.
It could hack through wooden shields and cleave through bronze helmets with terrifying force. The Iberian smiths were also renowned for their iron quality. They would bury plates of iron in the ground and let them rust.
Let them rust? Why?
Because the weak iron would corrode away, leaving only the strongest, highest carbon steel behind to be forged into the blades.
That is incredibly clever, and I find it deeply ironic that Rome, Carthage's great existential enemy, ends up adopting these weapons. The sources point out that Rome was so impressed by Iberian weaponry that they essentially copied the Iberian short-thrusting sword, renaming it the Gladius Hispaniensis.
They did.
They even adopted the Iberian dagger, the Pugio. Rome's most famous, iconic weapons, the ones they used to conquer the world, were essentially stolen Carthaginian contractor designs.
It is a perfect illustration of cultural synthesis in ancient warfare. Because Carthage brought together so many disparate fighting styles under one operational banner, their armies acted as a cross-pollinator of military technology across the Mediterranean.
Because they faced everyone.
Right. When a Roman legionary fought a Carthaginian army, he wasn't just fighting North Africans. He was fighting the absolute best military technologies of Europe and Africa simultaneously.
Yeah.
If a weapon worked against the Romans eventually adopted it.
Speaking of European technology, Carthage also heavily recruited from Gaul. Now, when we think of Gallic warriors, the stereotype is just wild, screaming barbarians charging in loose formation. But there's a deep mechanical sophistication to them as well, right?
Yes, definitely. The stereotype of the wild charge is partially true. The Gauls relied heavily on the psychological shock of a ferocious, screaming advance. They fought in a much looser order than the disciplined Iberian shield walls because they needed room to swing their long, slashing broadswords.
But their technology was advanced.
Their technological contribution to the Carthaginian army was profound. The Gauls were exceptional metallurgists. They invented chainmail armor.
Let us pause on chainmail because we take it for granted now, but how does that actually work compared to a solid bronze breastplate?
Well, a solid bronze cuirass provides excellent protection, but it is rigid, heavy, and restricts breathing and movement. Chainmail, which the Gauls called Lorica Hamata when the Romans eventually adopted it, is composed of thousands of small, interlocking iron rings.
So it is a flexible web.
Exactly. Often a solid punched ring was linked with a riveted ring. When a sword strikes chainmail, the flexible web of rings disperses the kinetic energy of the blow across a wider area.
So it stops the cut.
Right. It prevents the blade from slicing the flesh while still allowing the warrior complete flexibility of the torso. It was such an effective design that it became the military standard for armor across Europe for the next 1,000 years. Carthage was utilizing this cutting-edge armor long before the Romans widely adopted it.
So you have the heavy, disciplined Iberians, the ferociously aggressive Gauls in chainmail, but an army needs mobility. That brings us to the North African contingents, specifically the Numidian cavalry. These riders seem almost supernatural in the accounts.
The Numidians were semi-nomadic peoples from the regions west of Carthage, modern-day Algeria. Their relationship with horses was entirely different from the heavy cavalry of the Greeks or Macedonians. They rode small, incredibly agile ponies.
And the most unusual detail to foreign observers was that they rode without bridles or saddles?
Yes, completely bareback.
How do you control a war horse in the chaos of battle without a bridle or a bit in its mouth?
They controlled the mounts with a simple rope around the horse's neck, using shifts in their body weight, knee pressure, and vocal commands. The bond between the rider and the horse was profound.
And without armor, they must have been fast.
Exceptionally fast. They operated as elite, light cavalry skirmishers. Their tactic was the hit and run. They would dart toward an enemy line, completely ignoring traditional formations.
What weapons did they use?
They carried bundles of light javelins. They would unleash a shower of these javelins into the enemy ranks, and the moment the enemy tried to close the distance or retaliate, the Numidians would wheel their nimble ponies around and vanish.
It sounds incredibly frustrating to fight against. You cannot catch them, but they are constantly bleeding your heavy infantry.
Frustrating and exhausting. They would harass an enemy line for hours, forcing soldiers to keep their heavy shields raised, draining their stamina, and breaking their formation before the main heavy infantry clash even occurred.
For ranged support, they didn't just rely on cavalry javelins. They brought in the Balearic slingers. These were men from the Balearic Islands off the coast of Spain. Now, a sling sounds like a child's toy, like David and Goliath, but in the ancient world, a trained slinger was arguably more lethal than an archer.
They absolutely were.
Can you explain the physics of why the Balearic slingers were so devastating?
Sure. A sling is essentially a pouch with two long cords. The slinger places a projectile in the pouch, swings it rapidly to build centrifugal force, and releases one cord to launch the projectile. The Balearic Islanders used lead bullets shaped like almonds rather than simple river stones.
And lead is much denser.
Lead is incredibly dense. When hurled by an expert slinger, a lead bullet could travel over 200 yards. The velocity was immense.
What happens when a lead sling bullet hits a soldier? It is not piercing them like an arrow.
No, it causes massive blunt force trauma. If it strikes a helmet, the sheer kinetic energy can cause a severe concussion, fracturing the skull beneath the bronze.
Ouch.
Yeah. If it strikes a shield, the impact can shatter the wood or break the arm of the man holding it. Furthermore, a lead bullet is small and travels incredibly fast. It is virtually invisible in the air.
You cannot see it coming to raise your shield in time.
Right, and the Balearic slingers were trained from birth. The sources claim that mothers would place their children's daily meals on a high tree branch, and the child was required to strike the food with a sling stone before they were allowed to eat.
That level of lifelong specialization explains their value. The sources also mention a very unusual compensation method for these slingers. Because they lived in a somewhat isolated, barter-heavy society, Carthage often paid them not in silver, but in wine and enslaved women.
Which really underscores the varied, highly customized nature of these mercenary contracts. Carthage tailored the payment to whatever the specific unit valued most.
So the Carthaginian quartermasters had to manage multiple different streams of compensation. Silver for the Gauls, wine for the slingers, perhaps specific trade goods for the Numidians. It was a logistical puzzle.
A huge one, yes.
So we have the specialists, the skirmishing cavalry, the heavy shock troops, the slingers, but the heavy, disciplined core of the army, the anvil that these hammers struck against, was provided by the Libyans.
The subjects bound by treaty.
Right. Now, there's a significant scholarly debate regarding exactly how these Libyan infantry fought. What is the nature of this disagreement?
Well, the debate centers on the mechanics of their phalanx formation. We know they fought in a dense block of infantry, but the specifics are contested. One camp argues they fought as a classical Greek hoplite phalanx.
How does that work?
In this system, the soldiers utilize shorter spears, maybe 8 feet long, and carry a large bowl-shaped wooden shield called a hoplon. The shields overlap, creating a literal wall of wood and bronze, with the short spears thrusting over or under the shields.
And what is the alternative theory?
The alternative is that they fought as a Macedonian-style phalanx. This system, popularized by Alexander the Great, relies on a much longer two-handed pike known as the sarissa, which could be up to 18 feet long.
That is a huge weapon.
It is. Because both hands are required to hold the pike, the soldier carries a much smaller shield strapped to his forearm. The defense comes not from a wall of shields, but from a dense thicket of spear points extending many yards in front of the front rank, keeping the enemy completely at bay.
Why can't we just look at the sources and see which one they use?
Because the ancient Greek historians, like Polybius, used terminology that can be translated in multiple ways. They use generic words for spear or shield that don't give us the precise dimensions.
So it is ambiguous.
Yes. However, many modern historians lean toward the hoplite style, at least in the earlier periods, because the Macedonian sarissa requires constant, year-round drilling to keep the long pikes from getting tangled. It is highly complex. The hoplite shield wall is somewhat more intuitive for conscripted troops.
Whether they were holding short spears or long pikes, this diverse force, Iberians, Gauls, Numidians, Libyans, and Balearics, was the hammer Carthage swung in its enemies. However, there was one notable, glittering exception to this entirely outsourced multi-ethnic army.
There was.
While the bulk of the forces were hired or conscripted foreigners, there was an elite corps made up entirely of native Carthaginians.
Yes, a unit that historians refer to as the Sacred Band of Carthage.
The Sacred Band was a volunteer force. It was composed of 2,000 to 3,000 of the wealthiest, most noble Carthaginian citizens. The name itself, Sacred Band, actually comes to us from Greek historians who were drawing parallels to the famous Sacred Band of Thebes.
Right. These men were the absolute upper crust of a fabulously wealthy mercantile empire.
I want to talk about their visual splendor because understanding how they looked helps explain their role. What did a soldier in the Sacred Band wear into battle?
It was an ostentatious, almost intimidating display of the city's wealth. Because these men were aristocrats, they purchased their own gear, and they spared absolutely no expense. Their tunics were dyed in Tyrian purple.
Let us explain Tyrian purple, because it was not just a color, it was a statement of immense wealth, correct?
Absolutely. Tyrian purple was the most expensive substance in the ancient world. It was a dye extracted from the Murex sea snail. It took tens of thousands of rotting snails, processed in large vats, to produce just enough dye to color a single garment.
So wearing a tunic of Tyrian purple was the equivalent of driving a fleet of modern supercars onto the battlefield.
It signaled that you possessed unimaginable resources.
And they adorned these tunics with gold embroidery. The sources also mentioned they wore muscled cuirasses.
Yes, armor forged from bronze or iron, anatomically sculpted to resemble an idealized muscular human torso. Below the cuirass, they wore layered skirts of leather or linen called terruges to protect the groin and thighs, and heavy bronze greaves on their lower legs.
Did they wear animal skins, too?
Their officers often wore animal skin helmets, draping themselves in the pelts of lions or leopards hunted in the African interior. We also have archaeological evidence from Carthaginian graves suggesting many of these elites adorned themselves with specific body paint and tattoos before battle.
The shields alone sound like something out of a myth. The sources describe them carrying large white hoplon shields, but the interiors were lined with rare elephant hide for extra durability.
And the exteriors were chiseled and intricately inlaid with precious metals, gold, silver, and ivory.
They bore religious motifs, right?
Yes. They would feature symbols of their chief gods like Tanit and Baal Hammon, or an apotropaic eye.
What is an apotropaic eye?
It was a common symbol designed to literally ward off evil and turn away the enemy's gaze. The entire ensemble was designed to be visually overwhelming.
Tactically, how did a unit like this function? They look beautiful, but how did they fight?
They fought as a heavy infantry phalanx, locked tightly together. And crucially, they were almost always deployed on the extreme right wing of the battle line.
Why the right wing specifically? Is there a mechanical reason for that?
In ancient phalanx warfare, the right wing was traditionally the place of honor, but it was also a structural necessity due to the mechanics of the shield wall. A soldier holds his heavy shield in his left hand, covering his own left side and the right side of the man next to him.
Meaning the right side of his own body is exposed.
Right. As an army marches forward, the entire formation, naturally, almost unconsciously, drifts toward the right, as every man seeks the protection of his neighbor's shield. The extreme right flank has no neighbor. Therefore, placing your best, most heavily armored, and most disciplined troops on the right wing is a necessity to anchor the line and prevent the formation from drifting into chaos or being flanked.
Hearing about their unimaginable wealth, their gold-inlaid shields and purple tunics, they sound a bit like the trust fund children of antiquity.
They do, yeah.
It begs the question, how did they maintain such elite, unyielding military discipline when they were so wealthy that they absolutely did not have to fight? They could have just stayed in their seaside villas and managed their trade fleets. Why risk death?
It is a fascinating paradox, but it makes sense when you look at their society. The discipline of the Sacred Band rested on a powerful intersection of civic duty, intense religious devotion, and immense social pressure.
So it was a social obligation.
In the Carthaginian aristocracy, military service was not just an obligation. Serving in the Sacred Band was a primary, almost mandatory pathway to securing political power at home.
So it was a proving ground.
Exactly. You had to prove your worth, your physical courage, and your devotion to the city and its gods on the battlefield before you could be trusted to lead in the Senate or manage state affairs. It was an exclusive brotherhood.
And failure was not an option.
To flee from battle or to show cowardice would mean utter social and political ruin upon returning to Carthage. You would be ostracized.
And they certainly did not lack for courage. There is a tragic vignette that perfectly illustrates their resolve, though it ended in disaster for Carthage. Let us look at the Battle of Crimisus in 339 BCE. The Carthaginian army is operating in Sicily. They are attempting to cross the Chromisus River when they are suddenly ambushed by Greek forces.
It was a tactical nightmare. An army is most vulnerable when crossing a river, as their formation is broken and movement is restricted. The Greek forces, led by Timoleon, struck while the Carthaginian army was divided by the water.
The situation quickly became chaotic.
Unwinnable, really, for the Carthaginians.
But the Sacred Band held their ground. While the mercenaries and subjects broke and fled, the Sacred Band stood firm to cover the retreat of the rest of the army. They fought in the mud of the riverbank until they were completely annihilated. The sources indicate the loss of 2,500 elite aristocratic citizens in a single afternoon.
The loss of 2,500 elites sent absolute shockwaves through the city of Carthage. This was not the loss of hired Gauls or conscripted Libyans. This was a severe, irreplaceable blow to the ruling class itself. Entire familial dynasties were wiped out in a few hours of fighting.
We see them make another valiant final stand later at the Battle of White Tunis in 310 BCE, again fighting to the bitter end against an invading Greek force.
And these staggering losses cemented their doctrine. The trauma of Chromisus reinforced their deed hesitation to deploy citizen soldiers. It proved exactly why they preferred to spend silver rather than blood. The destruction of the Sacred Band essentially solidified their reliance on the multi-ethnic mercenary system we discussed earlier.
Now, beyond the infantry, the cavalry, and the elites, Carthage dominated the Mediterranean theater through two unique assets that really captured the ancient imagination: the natural world of the African continent and the maritime world of the sea. Let us talk about the beasts of burden first, the war elephants.
When we talk about Carthaginian war elephants, we have to be specific about biology. They utilized a specific species, the North African forest elephant, scientifically known as Loxodonta africana ferroensis.
Are they still around today?
No, this species is now extinct, largely due to overhunting and climate shifts during the Roman period.
How does the North African forest elephant compare to the elephants we see in zoos today?
They were significantly smaller. The large African bush elephants you see on the savannah today can stand over 10 or 11 feet tall. The Indian elephants used by Hellenistic kingdoms in the East were also quite large. The North African forest elephant stood about 8 to 8.5 feet at the shoulder.
So they were more compact.
More compact, perhaps slightly more docile to train, but still incredibly powerful animals.
Because they were smaller, there is a lot of debate in the sources and among modern scholars about how they were equipped for battle. Specifically, did these smaller elephants carry turrets, the wooden towers holding archers or spearmen on their backs?
It is a contentious issue. Some scholars look at the anatomy and argue that an 8-foot elephant is simply too small to bear the weight of a heavy wooden turret and multiple soldiers without suffering spinal injury or exhaustion.
So they think it just had a rider.
Right. They argue the elephant was ridden only by a single mahout, the driver who sat on its neck. However, other historians point to ancient terracotta figurines and coinage depicting Carthaginian elephants, and these sometimes show evidence suggesting a small, lightweight, one-man turret was entirely possible.
But regardless of what was constructed on their back, their primary tactical function was not necessarily as mobile archery platforms, right? It was psychological shock.
Their value was almost entirely rooted in sheer terror. I mean, consider being a Roman infantryman or an Italian allied cavalryman who has never left the Italian peninsula. You've never seen an animal larger than a bull.
And then this thing appears.
Suddenly, the earth shakes, and a wall of gray flesh, strange smells, and deafening trumpeting charges at your line. The psychological impact is devastating. Furthermore, they were incredibly effective against enemy cavalry.
Because of the horses?
Horses are prey animals. A horse that is unfamiliar with the scent and sound of an elephant will simply refuse to charge it. It will panic and throw its rider. The elephants were utilized to shatter formations before the infantry even engaged.
But moving an 8-foot elephant is one thing. Moving an entire empire's multi-ethnic army, thousands of horses, tons of silver, and dozens of elephants across the Mediterranean Sea is another. This brings us to the true jewel of the Carthaginian military apparatus, the navy. Contrast the mercenary land army, which was almost entirely outsourced, with the navy.
The navy was the lifeblood of the empire, and it was manned almost entirely by Carthaginian citizens. It was the institution that allowed everything else to function.
At the heart of this maritime dominance was the Cothon, their magnificent military harbor in the city of Carthage. How did the Cothon actually function?
The Cothon was an architectural marvel of the ancient world. It was an artificial circular harbor dug directly into the coastline, hidden behind high walls so that observers at sea could not look inside.
What was inside?
In the center of this circular harbor was an island, which housed the admiral's headquarters. Radiating out from the center, along the perimeter of the harbor, were hundreds of individual ship sheds.
Like dry docks.
Yes, dry docks with sloped slipways. A warship, like a trireme or a quinquereme, would be pulled out of the water and up into these sheds to protect the timber from rotting and to allow shipwrights to clean the hulls of barnacles, which dragged down the ship's speed.
And within this complex, Carthage perfected what we can only describe as a proto-assembly line system. The speed at which they could build fleets is mind-boggling. How did they achieve that without modern machinery?
Through rigorous standardization, Carthage mass-produced ships using prefabricated parts. We know this from marine archaeology, specifically shipwrecks discovered off the coast of Sicily near Marsala.
What did they find?
When archaeologists examined the timber of these sunken Carthaginian warships, they found Punic letters and numbers painted and carved into the wood. Every piece of timber, every rib, every bench was standardized, marked with a specific letter indicating precisely where it fit into the hull.
So it was essentially ancient flat-pack furniture.
Precisely. You did not need a master shipwright to custom carve every plank. You just needed laborers to assemble piece A to piece B. This meant that if a fleet was destroyed in a storm, Carthage could pull prefabricated timber from storehouses and assemble a new fleet of 100 warships in a matter of weeks.
A feat that astounded and terrified their enemies.
It really did.
And the social mechanics of who manned these ships were brilliant. We talked about the wealthy aristocrats serving as officers or in the sacred band, but the lower classes, the poorer citizens of Carthage, served as rowers and sailors in the fleet. And crucially, they received stable, reliable wages from the state for doing so.
That wage system provided profound social stability. When you study the ancient Mediterranean, a recurring theme in cities like Athens or Rome is the constant threat of the unemployed, debt-ridden, poorer classes rising up in violent social revolutions. They demand land redistribution or debt forgiveness.
But you rarely see that level of class warfare in Carthage.
Because the Navy functioned as a massive public works program. A quinquereme requires hundreds of rowers. By providing steady, respectable government jobs to thousands of lower class citizens, Carthage effectively insulated itself from internal uprisings.
So everyone had a stake in the system.
The citizens had a vested economic interest in the survival and dominance of the state. It solved a domestic social problem while simultaneously ensuring absolute dominance over the sea lanes.
The scale of their supply chain and their production capacity is hard to fathom. During the Third Punic War, right before the city was destroyed, the sources note that Carthage had stockpiled over 200,000 sets of armor and 2,000 catapults within the city. That is an industrial level of production.
Very much so.
But this brings up a logistical question for me. Let us say you have the armor, you have the ships, you have hired the Gauls and the Numidians, and you have trained the elephants. How on earth do you coordinate shipping a diverse army, their equipment, their horses, and their elephants across the unpredictable Mediterranean Sea without losing them to a sudden storm?
It was an incredibly perilous endeavor, and they did, on several occasions, suffer devastating losses to weather. Entire fleets and armies were swallowed by storms.
Because the ships were vulnerable.
Because ancient galleys had very shallow drafts, they sat high in the water, they were exceptionally vulnerable to rough seas. The safest method of maritime deployment was a gradual, highly orchestrated process. You could not just load 60,000 men and elephants onto ships in Carthage and sail straight into the unknown.
So how did they stage an invasion?
They relied on secure operational bases. For example, the heavily fortified city of Lilybaeum on the western tip of Sicily. Carthage would ferry troops over the narrowest stretch of water in smaller, heavily escorted convoys, waiting for optimal weather windows. They would gradually amass their forces in the secure theater, stockpiling food and weapons over months before finally marching out to face the enemy.
But sometimes they did not have a luxury of time or a secure harbor. There is the story of Commander Hanno at the Battle of Himera, which perfectly illustrates the danger of amphibious operations.
Hanno provides a great vignette of the absolute vulnerability of maritime deployment. During operations in Sicily, he had to deploy his forces in one enormous convoy, landing right on the doorstep of the enemy without a secure harbor. He beached his ships on the sand.
But a beached fleet is completely defenseless.
Right. To protect his vulnerable ships from being burned by the enemy while his army conducted a siege inland, Hanno was forced to literally build a makeshift wooden fort around the ships on the beach.
It highlights that while naval supremacy allows you to drop troops anywhere on the map, An amphibious landing in the ancient world left an army exposed and reliant on immediate, desperate fortification.
A navy projects power. But the moment the soldier steps off the boat, the logistical nightmare begins.
Having built this staggering machine, recruited the men, minted the silver, and built the ships, we have to examine how it actually performed under pressure. Because an army looks great on paper, but combat is the ultimate test. Let us look at its brilliant tactical peaks and its catastrophic financial failures.
The highs and lows.
Let us jump to the First Punic War. Things are going poorly for Carthage on land against the Romans. The Romans had superior heavy infantry. Enter a Spartan mercenary commander named Xantippus in 256 BCE.
Xantippus is a fascinating historical figure. He arrives in Carthage, reviews the army, and immediately recognizes a fundamental flaw in how the Carthaginian generals were utilizing their assets.
What were they doing wrong?
Out of a justifiable fear of the heavy Roman infantry legions, the Carthaginian commanders had been hiding their armies. They were deploying their forces in rough, uneven, mountainous terrain, hoping the hills would protect them from the Roman advance.
What was the problem with that?
Xanthippus realized that hiding in the hills completely negated Carthage's two greatest military strengths, their fast Numidian cavalry and their war elephants. Rough terrain disrupts a phalanx, yes, but it renders cavalry useless, and elephants cannot charge down steep, rocky inclines effectively.
So Xantippus restructures the entire doctrine. He takes command and forces the Carthaginian army to march down out of the hills and onto the wide open plains.
He maximizes the cavalry by placing them on the extreme wings where they have room to sweep around the enemy. And crucially, he places the elephants directly in front of the infantry phalanx.
What was the goal there?
His goal was to use the elephants as a living battering ram to shatter the rigid Roman lines before they even reached the spearmen. And the geometry of it worked brilliantly, leading to a crushing Carthaginian victory at the Battle of Bagratis River.
It demonstrated a vital truth about the Carthaginian military. When properly commanded, this multi-ethnic army was devastating, but it was a fragile instrument. It required a tactical genius to coordinate all those disparate moving parts, to communicate across language barriers, and to synchronize light cavalry, heavy infantry, and elephants.
We see this genius reach its absolute zenith with the Barsid dynasty, specifically following the First Punic War. Carthage lost that war, and they were forced to pay an enormous indemnity to Rome. The state treasury was completely depleted.
How did the military machine survive without silver?
This is where Hamilcar Barca steps in. He recognized the fatal flaw in the state's funding model. If the state has no money, the army ceases to exist. So Hamilcar shifted the financial burden of paying the mercenaries from the state directly onto himself.
By doing what?
He took an army to the Iberian Peninsula and aggressively conquered the rich Spanish silver mines. He bypassed the Carthaginian Senate and essentially created a privately funded, privately loyal state army operating out of Spain.
And his son, Hannibal Barca, took that privately funded army into legend during the Second Punic War. Hannibal's 15-year campaign in Italy is rightly studied as a masterclass in logistics and leadership. I try to wrap my head around the mechanics of it.
It is difficult to comprehend.
He sustained a multinational force of Iberians, Gauls, Numidians, and Africans deep in hostile Roman territory for a decade and a half. He was cut off from major maritime supply lines. He had to rely on pure charisma, aggressive battlefield foraging, and tactical brilliance to keep that fragile coalition fed, paid, and from fracturing.
Hannibal's ability to maintain cohesion among mercenaries who hadn't seen home in years, while constantly maneuvering through enemy territory, is arguably a greater achievement than his famous victory at Cannae. He was the ultimate manager of this complex machine.
But the tragedy of the Carthaginian system is that their weapons, specifically their technological terror weapons, could be turned against them by an adaptive enemy. Let us look at the Battle of Zama in 202 BCE, the final battle of the Second Punic War. The Roman general Scipio Africanus figured out how to neutralize the elephants.
Scipio analyzed the mechanics of an elephant charge. An elephant, despite its size, will naturally take the path of least resistance. It does not want to run into a solid object if it can avoid it.
So what did Scipio do?
So Scipio trained his disciplined Roman infantry to change their formation. When the Carthaginian elephants charged, the Roman maniples simply stepped aside, opening up wide, empty lanes in their own lines.
The beasts were funneled through the gaps harmlessly. They just ran right through the open corridors without trampling anyone.
Right. And to compound the disaster, Scipio used loud horns and trumpets to blast sudden, deafening noise at the elephants. The animals, many of which were young and poorly trained due to the long war, panicked. They turned around and stampeded backward, rampaging straight through Carthage's own cavalry and infantry lines.
It was the moment their ultimate shock weapon literally destroyed their own formation.
Yes.
But for all the drama of Zama, the most terrifying collapse of the Carthaginian machine was not a battlefield defeat against Rome. It was a financial default against their own men. I am talking about the Mercenary War, which raged from 240 to 238 BCE in the aftermath of the First Punic War.
This event perfectly illustrates the danger of the outsourced military. Hmm. Following the First Punic War, Carthage owed a staggering amount of back pay to the tens of thousands of troops who had been fighting in Sicily for years. But as we discussed, the treasury was empty, having been drained by the war effort and the Roman indemnities.
So what happens when a city filled with wealth tells an army of hardened killers that their paychecks are going to bounce?
Carthage made a fatal error. They delayed paying the troops. They gathered the army outside the city and tried to renegotiate Themistos, asking the soldiers to accept a fraction of what they were owed. The Libyan conscripts and the foreign mercenaries, camped just miles from the wealthy estates of the men who hired them, grew increasingly anxious and angry.
And then rumors started.
Then a rumor spread among the Libyans that the Carthaginian Senate was planning to execute the leadership of the army to avoid paying the silver.
Fear and delayed pay are a highly volatile combination. The troops revolted.
They didn't just revolt. They sparked a conflict of unimaginable brutality. The ancient sources call it the Truceless War. It was an entire war fought entirely over a broken financial contract.
The very weapons they bought turned on them.
The falcatas, the Numidian ponies, the men Carthage had purchased to protect them turned around and besieged the city. The rebels tortured Carthaginian emissaries. Carthage responded by executing prisoners by having them trampled by elephants. It was a war of total annihilation driven by financial betrayal.
It really makes me wonder if the true fatal flaw of Carthage was ever actually military strategy. Was it simply an accounting error? Did they just run out of liquid capital and the whole house of cards fell down?
That is the ultimate vulnerability of their entire system. The Carthaginian military machine was virtually invincible as long as the cash flowed smoothly. It was a purely transactional relationship. But a transactional relationship lacks deep roots. Once the treasury dried up, the loyalty evaporated instantly. It highlights the profound fragility of an empire built entirely on purchased loyalty.
It is a stark contrast to how Rome operated.
A profound contrast. Rome built an empire on deep structural assimilation. When Rome defeated an Italian city-state, they didn't just hire their men, they integrated those Italian allies, offering them a stake in the Republic, shared legal rights, and a promised share of the agricultural loot. Roman allies fought alongside legions because they were made part of the system.
Carthaginian allies fought because they were paid silver or coerced by treaties.
When the money stopped, the Carthaginian system collapsed upon itself.
It is a profound lesson in the limits of outsourced power. You can buy the sharpest swords in the world, but you cannot buy the devotion of the man swinging it.
It leaves us with a compelling question to consider as we wrap up this deep dive. As you think about the rise and fall of this magnificent merchant empire, ask yourself this. Did Carthage ultimately fall because they relied on the swords of foreigners? Or did they fall because they fundamentally failed to assimilate their allies the way Rome did, ensuring that when the money stopped, the loyalty stopped too?
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.